Brought to you by Black Knight, it's the technology.ie podcast. Episode 32 for June 7th, 2012, with Michaela Nealon and Conor Muinichon. Gotta say thanks, as always, to Keela for the theme music for the technology.ie podcast. Michaela and I picked it out way back at the start. It's called Her Royal Waggledy Toes. You're still enjoying that, Michaela, are you?
Of course. I love Keela. I think they're a great group.
Excellent. Well, welcome to the podcast, Michaela. We usually record of an evening, Wednesday evening in Ireland. It's actually Wednesday afternoon in Ireland, June 6th. And it's Wednesday morning where you are. Where is that?
I'm in Scottsdale in Arizona.
What for?
I'm over here for a meeting between a bunch of registrars, which is being held in Scottsdale, Arizona, starting tomorrow morning.
Okay.
So it's a two-day meeting. We'll be talking about all those exciting things that I like and that everybody else finds terribly boring, such as, you know, policy and, you know, what's going on in the big bad world of I suppose a lot of it's actually policy, I suppose, really. Like there's a bunch of people coming in. We're talking about abuse, liability, fake pharmaceuticals, new TLDs, UDRP, malware, intellectual property theft, these kind of things. So there's a whole range of different things. And of course, we'll also be talking about the RAA.
The which?
The RAA.
What is that?
That's the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, which is the contract between registrars and ICANN. We've mentioned this a couple of times.
We talked about it last week, and you're fairly annoyed about it. You've blogged about it. You feel that it's making registrars treat their customers as criminals.
Yes, I feel very, very strongly about it. I'm quite incensed. Mm.
Are you going to get support for that view from other registrars at this meeting in Arizona?
From some of them, I'd say yes. From others, I'm not too sure, because you know there's a lot of different types of businesses involved in the registrar space, and for some entities, you know, certain things that don't really impact them directly, because you know some registrars basically only deal with themselves. I mean, they hold large portfolios of names which they then sell to other people. They don't actually allow public registrations. Others are dealing with big corporates, trademark holders. You know, they all have different types of businesses. So some of the proposed changes probably won't impact some of those companies as much as would impact companies such as ourselves. But I think by and large, from what I've been able to gather from talking to various other registrars, a lot of them aren't exactly impressed. Because even for the ones that are dealing with corporates, there's all sorts of interesting issues around the data. So for example, while a big corporate registrar would have a physical signed contract with each and every client, and in other words, knows exactly who they're dealing with, they have other issues there, because they might have lots of NDAs and other kind of things floating around, or maybe there's sensitive financial information that has been shared, and obviously they don't want to give that to a third party unless they're absolutely obliged to.
I got to say, Michaela, you're right. Most of us do find it boring, but I have to say thank you on behalf of those of us who do. You deal with this stuff on behalf of those of us who do find it boring, so we don't have to. So I do appreciate it. And we'll return back to this. It's a little bit like IP version 6, IPv6, which I know is a drum you've beaten from time to time and pointed out that sites don't support it, that should support it and things like that. Most people kind of have looked at this at one point or another and said, okay, yeah, got to do that at some stage down the line. Michaela, we've been talking about this for 20 years at least, certainly for 10, 12 years that I remember, the fact that we're well out of address space in the IPv4. There's only, you know, so much space there, and it's being used as creatively as possible. We're really starting to feel the strain now, though, aren't we, in IPv4?
Oh, totally. I mean, the thing is, like, last year, IPv4 space came to an end. I mean, what that means is that the last blocks were allocated to the regions. So, you know, there's one, Wright looks after Europe, Aaron looks after the US, and there's, you know, a couple of others, ones for Asia, et cetera, et cetera. And now what's happening is that, you know, okay, first of all, I suppose you should say, you know, what exactly is IPv4, what is IPv6? I mean, IPv4 is the number, it's an IP address number, so like 192.168.0.0.1, that would be an IPv4 address, whereas an IPv6, it's a longer number. I mean, actually, they use letters as well as numbers to describe it. And the thing is that this is not something that's going to go away. I mean, there is a finite number of IPv4 addresses available, and when they run out, you run into massive issues.
We're talking about 256 to the power of 4 is basically all that's there. You know, so that's all you've got. There's more IPv6 addresses there than there are atoms in the universe. Is that true, or...?
Yeah, no, that would be it. I mean, the volumes you're dealing with, I mean, the number of IPv6 addresses that you can have is huge. I mean, it's I'm not somebody normally stuck for words, but I'm trying. But to find a word to describe the sheer size of IPv6 space is a challenge. I mean, you could talk about, you know, numbers to the power or something else. I mean, it's a huge, huge number.
So right now we're doing all kinds of creative stuff with IPv4, where ISPs are assigning IP addresses to their customers, basically, you know, on a ad hoc basis, and you know, you get one for, you know, if you're not using it, if you turn it off, they're going to give it to somebody else. There's all kinds of aliasing going on and things like that as well. But it's a lot of hard work, isn't it?
Well, it doesn't scale. I mean, this is the problem. Because, I mean, ultimately, you know, more and more devices use the internet and networks. I mean, both the public, the private. I mean, we're talking about the internet here in the much broader sense. We're not talking about the web, which I think a lot of people think of the internet as being the web. I mean, if you remember from talking to Barry a couple of weeks ago, you know, a lot of the stuff that was going on before the web, as it were, was born, that was using TCP/IP, that was using IPv4. But now, I mean, I'm sitting here in a hotel room in Arizona. You're talking to me over a VoIP connection into my phone. The laptop in front of me is connected over Wi-Fi. I've got a mobile phone here in my bag in front of me. I've got a Kindle and I've got an iPad. The TV in the room uses various net type services to provide me with films and various other services on demand.
And that's before we even start talking about the broader Internet of Things and having an IP address for your car and your fridge and your everything your fridge and your cup and all of this kind of thing as well. So,
I'm just looking around a hotel room.
Are we, Michele, at a stage with IPv4 and all of the creative gymnastics that people have to do to actually make the most of this limited address space? Are we at a stage where that's actually impeding development?
It depends on where you are. You know, it's one of those questions that doesn't have a simple, short answer. I mean, in some countries, the ISPs, government, and everything else have made significant investment and have moved things forward. So, James, who's over in France and works with ourselves, the ISP he's using gives him IPv6.
Okay.
If you're in the Netherlands, you'd have IPv6 from quite a few of the providers.
And it's an old standard. I mean, not so much an old standard, but it's been there for a long time. It's just, what's the delay in adopting it? Why haven't companies adopted? And we'll come in a moment to the World IPv6 launch, which is today, 6th of June 2012. And a lot of companies, as you say, are flicking the switch and going forward on that. But what has been the delay? What's taken it so long? It's going back, as I say, it must be what? It's back well into the 90s anyway, isn't it?
I'm actually trying to find the exact date for when IPv6 was first mooted as a concept. But, I mean, it's something that, I mean, we've been talking about it internally since almost nearly 10 years. It's described in an RFC from 1998. So, yeah, it's been around for a while. I mean, and you know, to get to an RFC, they would have been talking about it for quite some time before that. Mm-hmm. The problem is that for a lot, you know, when you're talking to companies and businesses in general, it's not enough to say this is a good idea or this is a nice idea or this is innovative or anything like that. You have to be able to give them a motivator, something. Mm-hmm. that will drive them to make a change. So as long as there was enough IPv4 space available, there was no reason for a lot of these companies to do anything serious about it. Now, all the ISPs in Ireland and pretty much everywhere else did experiments in IPv6, but if you actually look at Ireland now, you'll find that none of the big ISPs have actually deployed IPv6 to their users. And I'm talking about Vodafone, Aircom, BT, UPC, and whoever else is out there who, you know, has a national presence. Not one of them has actually deployed it nationally.
Now, there's a worldwide initiative, as you point, as you've been telling me, Michaela, this today, 6th of June 2012, and a load of organisations such as...
Well, you've got Akamai, Comcast, Free Telecom, right. KDDI, Time Warner Cable, AT&T, yeah. D-Link, Google, Limelight, Access for All, Cisco, Facebook, Internode, Microsoft, Bing, Yahoo. Those are some of the real big names that are getting behind this. And last year we had World IPv6 Day, which was in some respects kind of like a beta test.
Yeah,
a lot of big content providers, you know, the likes of Facebook, Google, etc., turned on IPv6 for one day. And you know, some people didn't turn it off again, but you know, others did.
And as today, you say, significantly today. A lot of them are making that change for good.
Yeah, they've turned it on. Now, that doesn't mean it won't be available over IPv4. Mm. I mean, what we're talking about here is using what's called dual stacking. So a website will be available over both IPv4 and IPv6.
But it's backward compatible. Wasn't that the understanding that we have in relation to IPv4 and 6, that an IPv4 address is automatically and also an IPv6 address? Is that fair enough?
No.
Am I misunderstanding in relation to that? So they can't necessarily talk to each other?
Well, no, because I mean, IPv4 can only talk to IPv4. IPv6 can only talk to IPv6.
Okay.
So what you'd have is that, let's say, for example, here where I am at the moment, I'm on an IPv4 connection. There is no IPv6 in this location.
Right.
So I can connect to any website or any service online that is available over IPv4. It might be available over IPv6. I don't know, and I really don't need to know. Mm. If I was on an IPv6 connection, then I would be able to access any IPv6 enabled service, but I would probably the service would probably have a fallback to IPv4 available as well.
So you're saying this dual stacking, let's say I'm here as a client, I would have, if I had IPv6 from my internet service provider, I'd have an IPv6 stack and an IPv4 stack in the software in my PC here. And depending on, first of all, I might try to see if a site that I'm trying to connect with or a remote system supports IPv6. And if it doesn't, I'll fall back and use the other stack. Is that it?
Well, basically, yeah, we're talking about the internet connection between your computer and a website or a web service.
Yes.
So what would happen is that your computer might try to connect over IPv6, see if there's an IPv6 quad A address. If there isn't one, it will then look for the standard IPv4 A records and other records. And, you know, depending on what's available, we'll try to connect through to whichever one it can reach.
So it's non-trivial, really, either, as well, Michele. I mean, in fairness, I had thought that organisations were really dragging their heels and that it was simply a matter of the fact that IPv6 was backward compatible and that why don't they just turn it on and get on with it? No, there are practical issues to be dealt with. But again, this is a practical step forward on this World IPv6 launch day today to actually make that happen.
Well, yeah, I mean, the reality is that, you know, a lot of the equipment that you would probably have in your house or your office or whatever won't support IPv6 at the moment. Mm. If you have, you know, a standard router, a DSL modem type thing or whatever from an ISP, a lot of the older models do not support IPv6. Or if they do support IPv6, you'd have to upgrade the firmware to get that support. Mm. And of course, the thing is that, you know, again, with these older models, you know, doing an upgrade isn't an easy thing to do. It's not simply a question of logging in and going, hey, update me. You might need a bit more skill than that. So that's one of the problems, is that the end user equipment might not support it. There's been a lot of other issues as well surrounding things like firewalls and things like that. But, you know, some of the model firewalls just simply didn't support IPv6 at all, or had issues with certain types of services and everything else. I mean, there's a lot there, but ultimately, it's something that needs to happen because, you know, there aren't enough IPv4 addresses left.
I'm looking at a list of some of quotes on this email I got from you from various companies supporting it. And the key one that jumps out at me, there's obviously AT&T, Bing for Microsoft, Comcast, Facebook, all of these are in there. The key one that jumps out here is Cisco in relation to this, because there's so much of the networking and routing infrastructure here, aren't there?
Oh, they're huge. I mean, yeah. Cisco owns a whole load of other companies as well. I mean, they own Linksys.
Yeah.
They provide a lot of carrier grade equipment as well. But you need to look at the full chain. I mean, not just the big stuff that the carriers are using. You also need to look at what normal end users are using. So getting companies like Cisco on board is absolutely vital.
What do we need to do in Ireland, Michele?
Well, I think one thing that would be useful would be for government to, put IPv6 down as some kind of requirement in tender documents. Mm. So that, let's say, for example, if a tender goes out for a website for a government department or a semi-state, that IPv6 connectivity be included in there. Nothing like that's happening.
This is an example of the kind of area where perhaps government could show leadership, and it's something we're going to come to in part two of the show this week, Michele. We're going to refer to your column this week. We referred to it last year. It was published last Sunday in the Sunday Business Post, where you talk about, I suppose, Ireland needs a voice on internet policy is the headline you had on it. We're going to come to that, as I say, later in part two of the show. But let's lighten things up just a little bit. Very cool gadget, you said. What is this? Lytro.
This is the Lytro camera. I mean, I haven't heard anything about this, but actually one of the guys who's over here with me in Arizona had ordered one and got it delivered to the hotel because they're not available in Europe yet.
Lytro lets you take pictures like never before. Unlike a conventional camera that captures a single plane of light, the Lytro camera captures the entire light field, which is all the light travelling in every direction, in every point in space. I don't get it. What's this about? Is it like 3D camera, is it, Aura?
No. It's a really bizarre concept. I mean, I was playing around with it a bit last night and looking at it.
Go ahead. It's because it captures all the light in all directions, you can focus after the fact. Is that it?
Yeah.
Ah.
You can do really interesting things. So you take a photograph. you take a photograph of a standard camera. If you take a really high resolution shot, then you can zoom in quite far because, hey, you've got the resolution. But what this thing does is whatever way they are to capture the image, it means that you can then zoom in after the fact. Like this, if you go onto the website, you can play around with the technology, and they'll show you this kind of thing. It's where you can zoom in, and something is in focus. You can, like I'm looking at here, for example, is a photo of a flower. Mm. So the flower itself is in focus, but the stuff behind the flower, the other flowers, the background, all of that is out of focus. Mm. With this thing, you can actually do is you can go in and you can change the center of focus. So just by clicking on the demo, I've now made one of the things in the background the center of focus.
And you can actually do that. You can do this in the demo. You can see that with some of these demo pictures they have up, and you can change the focus to whatever you like.
Yeah.
Wow.
But the weird thing is, I mean, if you actually look at the photos of the device itself, I mean, it's like it's not like a normal camera. I mean, in terms of the physical device, I mean, it's quite long. It doesn't even kind of look like a camera. It's like this. I mean, if you can actually put up a photograph or something, maybe on the to accompany this podcast, so people can see what we're talking about. It's a very strange looking device. It's quite long. It's not that big, but it's quite long. I mean,
it's like just a tube.
Yeah, it's like a tube. It's a very, very strange thing, and I didn't know anything about this. But one of the guys who's here I mean, he's big into photography, and he's like, you know, oh, this thing is amazing. This is like, you know, going to change your life, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I want to play around with it a little bit more and see if I can.
Are you getting one? Have you borrowed the one that the guy in Phoenix has at the moment?
Well, I want to have a look at it and see if we can take some photographs with it just to see what you can do.
Excellent.
I mean, it's not cheap. I mean, $399 for an 8-gig version, and then $499 for a 16-gig version.
Right.
So it's a little bit more expensive than your kind of toy.
This is, Michele, why we send you out to these places, to Phoenix, Arizona, or wherever it may be, and you find the cool stuff and come back and tell us all about it. One of the other, we'll post about that. Let's get a picture up of that. And if you can take pictures with it, Michele, and share them with us, that would be fantastic as well. Now, you were very excited. You've got big news this week because you've just made an announcement about Black Knight and .co.
Yeah, but this is for us now was a big deal because .co are very, very selective about which companies they'll partner with directly. When they initially launched, they only had 10 registrars. Now they've expanded that number a little bit, but for us as a medium-sized company, we're not the biggest registrar in the world or anything close to us. Being able to get that deal to go directly with them is something that I'm absolutely delighted about. Absolutely, it's fantastic.
Excellent.
So we'll be working with them closely in order to market .co to Irish businesses and other European businesses. Because, I mean, .co is what's really interesting about them is that they're very, very innovative and interesting around their marketing. They look at marketing the domain name in a whole different way. It's not just a case of, Ara, here's your domain name. They look at kind of getting involved in this entire kind of startup culture. I mean, that's why the switch for the web over to a .co was such big news for them. So we're delighted about this. We're going to be doing stuff with them in the coming months. I'm personally over the moon.
Well, what's that going to set you back at .co?
Are you the punter?
the punter. They're kind of a premium, though, aren't they?
Yeah, the part of the thing with .co is that it was a virgin space. I mean, there were no domains registered under .co, which meant that you had a huge choice. You could register whatever you wanted, but what they didn't want was people to go off and register loads and loads and loads of domain names and then never use them. So they've set the pricing on it. So it's more expensive than .com, but you still have the ease of registration that you would have for a .com. So you go through to our website, find a .co domain name that you like, pay for it, and the domain will be up and running within a few minutes. The fact that it's a little bit more expensive means that you're not going to have as many people just going off and registering all sorts of crazy and then not using them. With a .co being priced a little bit higher, hopefully people will actually do stuff, interesting stuff around it.
Yeah, and I guess that pays off in all kinds of ways. It increases the attractiveness of .co as well to people because .co then becomes a TLD that's associated with interesting stuff going on. But TLDs, Michele, we're going to be flooded with them now, and I can finally close the window.
They did.
Yeah.
I mean, this happened there last week, and after much messing about, they kept referring to it as a software glitch, which really wasn't the word I would have used.
Yeah, no, a glitch might shut you down for a few hours or maybe something like that. But this was down for what, 4 weeks?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, insane. I mean, considering the amount of money at play here, each applicant had paid ICANN $185,000.
Per TLD?
Per TLD, per domain extension that they were applying for.
Okay.
And ICANN is talking about having received something close to 2,000 applications. I mean, you can sit down, you can do the math, pop out your calculator, throw in the figures.
I'm about to, and in particular, in relation of that 2,000, 307 of those are coming from one company.
Yeah, this one took a lot of us by surprise. Donuts which was set up about 18 months ago, only specifically for new PLDs. The guys behind it include Paul Stahura, who founded Enom, which is one of the biggest registrars in the world, John Nevitt, who used to be with Network Solutions, and a few other people who are, you know, pretty well known within the domain industry. And, you know, everybody knew they were applying for new TLDs, but they hadn't said a word. They hadn't said how many domain extensions they were applying for or anything like that. And then yesterday, the news came out that they'd applied for not one, not 10, not 20, but 307.
I got the calculator out, Michele. That's $57 million, is it we're talking about here?
Yeah,
that's what they've spent to register those. That's going to cost. Okay, 307 GTLDs. Any idea what any of those are?
No clue.
But we'll find out
what the extensions are that they've applied for next week. I mean, the news has been coming out fast and furious over the last few days, as more and more of the applicants are putting out press releases about what they've applied for. Mm. Some of the strings sound really cool, and you can kind of go, hey, yeah, I can see how that would work. Other ones, you're left scratching your head, just going, what were they thinking?
What does this mean? Michele, we've talked before, we've interviewed domainers on the program. You're a domainer yourself. This is going to, I mean, really, it's like not just an entire continent has been discovered in terms of a namespace, but, you know, if all of these domain names, I guess some of them may be sort of defensive or some of them may not be immediately exploited, I don't know. But is this not going to create a glut of namespace on the, and is this, what's the impact of this going to be for domainers and for the domain industry, I suppose?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, or the $185,000 question, depending on what way you look at it. I honestly don't know, because when this was all being talked about, and it's been talked about for years, and you know, people were talking about what they wanted to apply for, and some names were put out there pretty early on, and you know, some you could go, yeah, I can see how that would work. I can see that has a market. I can see there being a demand for it. But when you look at the potential for this number of new extensions available, you end up with one basic fundamental question. How many domain names does the average person or business actually need? Mm. And that's going to be the key. I mean, at the moment, between you've got couple of hundred country code extensions, including, you know, .ie, .co.uk, .fr, etc., etc., etc. So that serves, you know, those national markets or anybody who wants to get into those markets with .eu covering the European Union, .asia for, you know, Asia, and of course, you know, .com and all the others at the top level, which cover, you know, the world. Now, I honestly don't know what's going to happen when you have this huge number of new extensions available. I mean, a lot of them, sure, they're going to be for big brands. You know, with Google made an announcement, they're applying for .google, .youtube, and a few other ones around their big brands. But how these companies intend to use them remains to be seen. Are they just going to register them, hold on to them, and then go do something with them in 5 or 10 years' time? Or are they going to do something with them actively as soon as possible? Nobody really knows. Mm. So I think it's something that we're going to have to watch more closely. And next week, what they'll be making the big announcement as to, you know, which strings have been applied for. And there's going to be quite a few clashes, or quite a few areas where there's contention. In other words, more than one applicant will have applied for the same string. I mean, so far, we know that there's at least three applicants for .green. There's at least four applicants for .music. And you're going to see more and more of that as the applications are actually announced. The full list of who's applied for what comes out. So it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see. It's going to be exciting. It's going to be challenge for everybody, and ultimately for, you know, you and anybody else out there who isn't involved in the industry, it's going to be it'll be interesting to watch to see how you guys react to it. And it'll be up to those of us on this side of it to make it interesting and appealing to you, I suppose.
Last week on the programme, another thing we talked about last week, Michele, was in relation to Google Places, and we talked about how important it is, I suppose, to make sure that you stake your claim, literally, in Google Places, and how important it can be for making sure you get found on Google and get found on location-based systems and things like that. And in fact, the following day, Google announced a sort of an upgrade of Google Places, didn't they, to Google Plus Local with Zagat reviews built in.
Yeah, I mean they're constantly tweaking this, and I think this is just one upgrade. There's going to be more. You're going to see more and more of this. I mean, local is where it's at. Mm. This is something that anybody working in SEO could have told you years ago. Mm. What Google are doing now, I mean, it's that kind of entire thing around Google Plus. You've got that Search Plus Your World thing, Google Places. All these things are all coming in together. And, you know, if Google doesn't do it, somebody else will. Now, obviously, Google is in a much better position to do it than anybody else. Mm. So, I mean, what they're talking about here is this Google Plus Local is the company's newest social integration and creates one simple experience across Google. The integration with Zagat makes sense because Zagat's primarily to do with restaurants, as far as I know. I'm not sure if they do anything else beyond that. Do they, Colin? Do you know?
I think they do for other things as well, restaurants, shops, and entertainment locations and things like that as well. But it's again, you know, I'm just wondering. Not necessarily every business is location specific. I mean, I have an office, for example, in County Clare. People come here occasionally, but very often I provide my services remotely to people. I travel to their office, whatever it may be. Again, I don't need to go to Carlow to be a customer of Black Knights. Is this something that you see as important from your business, or does it depend? Is it really the kind of business that has a shop front on the high street that really needs to be concerned about this?
Well, this is something that I always have an issue with, because it's like with Foursquare and a lot of the other location-based services. If, like ourselves in Black Knights, or even yourself to a lesser extent, the location is largely irrelevant, then it's very, very hard for us to leverage that kind of local marketing angle, because ultimately, you know, we don't particularly want to just attract business from Carlow. I mean, hey, anybody in Carlow wants to buy from us, great. But, you know, the market's far too small. I mean, we need to attract business from all of Ireland, all of Europe, and beyond. But I think the thing is that you've got to also look at it in a slightly different light. If you look at small businesses and the importance and the role that they play in most countries, it's all down to local. They're small businesses. Those are the ones that are driving the economy. Now, how companies that are operating nationally or internationally market themselves is going to be slightly different. But there's no reason why, say, a company that has multiple office locations wouldn't list each location separately on Google Places or other services like that. But for those of us who exist more online than anywhere else, it is a challenge, of course.
But it is all part, and we had Gavin from Google on last week. It is all part, really, of making sure that you, I suppose, make sure that you're represented and listed and appropriately have all the information you can have. And it adds to the importance, really, of Google Plus and having your Google Plus about page up to date, doesn't it, Michele?
Well, I mean, this is something that, excuse me, I think Google... I'm not sure whether it's a case of Google kind of going, right, you know, we have to push Google Plus, or whether they're looking at more in terms of tying everything in together and getting this kind of more kind of cohesive experience. Because you can do things now like tying your Google Plus profile back to blog posts and articles that you publish online. Mm. So when you do a search for certain terms, you'll see articles from people. You can then go off and explore other articles that same person has written, because they're able now to validate the author, which is an interesting take. So maybe it might work in some ways towards kind of more, I don't know how to say, kind of like verifying identity in some respects, if people want to actually do that voluntarily.
It's funny, I think that Google are somehow staking an important claim in this area. It's been something that's talked about for a long time. What's your Google identity? In fact, when Google profiles first came in, people said, yeah, this is a good play for that. Twitter has made a really very good claim for this kind of thing, is, you know, that's your identity, is twitter.com/mneelan or .com/con in my case. But the Google profile, I think, is definitely becoming more important.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, and they're also slowly but surely making it easier for you to have multiple accounts.
Yeah, they're fixing all of that. We've grumbled about that before, but
I mean, it's still not 100% by any stretch of the imagination. It is definitely moving in the right direction, and that's very, very important. That's going to make things easier for us moving forward.
Speaking of moving forward, Michele, and moving things in the right direction, we're going to talk in part two of the show about policy, about what you feel the kind of leadership we should be getting from our government in relation to that in this country. We're going to talk a little bit about what they're doing in the United States. President Obama has announced an executive order which mandates federal agencies to provide APIs, which again is something I think you've talked about in relation to e-government in the past in Ireland and that. And we might even get to talk a little bit about cyber warfare and that as well. We're also going to find out about what Black Knight is doing this week. But I also want to talk very briefly, Michele, about this proposal from Facebook. I don't know if you saw this. I've put a link in there for you in relation to this, that Facebook would make some kind of special, I suppose, training wheels account available to people under 13. And I think it's just for discussion. They've described it as something they're exploring at the moment, and I suppose trying to see what kind of feedback there is on it. But right now, the terms and conditions of Facebook mean that you cannot be a member unless you're 13 years old of Facebook. But that's a rule that's being flouted by young kids all over the world, and indeed sometimes even with their parents' acknowledgement and approval.
Setting an age limit, a minimum age limit or a minimum age requirement for membership of Facebook, while a nice idea, doesn't really scale unless you do some kind of, I don't know, some kind of verification or validation of each and every user, which, again, will not scale.
No.
So it really was kind of an honor system, and obviously people are going to circumvent that. But I mean, it's the same with, you know, the other policies that Facebook and other social networks might have. People will circumvent them.
That rule, let's face it, Michele, that rule is there to protect Facebook from litigation and from claims that they are allowing minors to be to be exposed, I suppose, to inappropriate content. That term of that 13-year-old minimum age requirement, that's there to protect Facebook more than it is even to protect children.
Oh, totally.
And they've covered themselves when they have a condition like this. So in a way, it's a kind of a sort of a bold thing and a sort of a brave thing. And I think a good thing in a way to say, look, let's see if there's a better way to do this other than simply putting this age requirement in place, because obviously that is not protecting kids. We've got kids going online pretending to be older, and we cannot protect them in that kind of an environment. I mean, I don't know if you know people under 13 on Facebook. I certainly know young members of my family who have, for one reason or another, lied about their ages and have their parents' approval to do so, because the parents can see that that social media is important and that it's something that, with a certain amount of supervision, that they feel, well, more greater or less lesser extent of supervision, depending on the home and the parent. But in many cases, they feel, you know, OK, I know you have to be 13, but let's go for it. Of course, in many cases, many parents aren't even aware of what their kids are doing online. That's more serious.
It is. But, I mean, you know, the thing again, though, is, I mean, if you're talking about protecting minors, I mean, a minor is somebody under the age of 18, not 13.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, I mean, it's something. I mean, the article that that you sent a link to there, you know, it's covering the fact that several of the U.S. politicians are a bit concerned about what Facebook is doing. Mm. I know this is something that it's going on elsewhere as well. I mean, the entire thing about, you know, how you market to children under a certain age. You know, in a lot of places, this is becoming something that's much more controlled now, whereas it was pretty much open season before.
But again, as I say, right now we have an outlawed situation where kids are online, let's say, and they're lying about their age. What Facebook are kind of proposing, running up the flagpole to see what people think about it, is say, let's make a special category of a child account. I think they said maybe kids over 8, between 8 and 13 could use, and that this account would be linked to a parent account. You'd need the parental approval to have an account such as this, and the parents could supervise their kids' activity and their kids' friendships and contacts online. Surely that's preferable, Michele.
Well, it is if you assume that they're all going to stick to it. You know, this is the thing. I mean, unless you change other things so that you're able to force them into that little space, that safe area, that whatever you want to call it, then otherwise, you know, it's not really going to have any real impact. I mean, people are going to circumvent the rules if they find that it's too restrictive.
But that's what I'm saying. If these rules are less restrictive than the current rules, then there may be an opportunity for people to play within the rules. Isn't that better?
Well, yeah, but again, you know, it depends on how people view this, whether they're going to adopt it and go, hey, okay, we now have access to this thing which allows us to do certain things, or they're going to go, oh, I don't like this, I want the full experience. Mm.
Another thing which was announced during the week, picked this up, I think I saw it on my Twitter feeds during the week, was Irish teachers banned from friending pupils. Now, the Teaching Council of Ireland is a national organisation. It's not a union as such, but it's a national organisation which sets standards for teachers at all levels in Ireland. And they've just published, in relation to this particular article on the on the Irish Times, teachers should not befriend their students on Facebook and other social networking sites, according to a new code of conduct agreed by the Teaching Council, the group that regulates the teaching profession. What do you think of that, Michele? On the face of it, it's proper professional behaviour, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think it's like everything else. I mean, it's, you know, these things need to develop over time. I mean, it's taken the teachers' organisation up until now to try to even formulate some kind of policy in this area. Mm. And the fact that they now have done something, I'm not sure what the exact status of it is, you know, that alone is a good sign. That's a good thing. You know, having a policy, it doesn't matter whether the policy is a good policy or a bad policy, means,
it's a
okay,
start.
We've looked at this, we've considered this is what we come up with, and then they can change it, you know, depending on how things pan out. Because I can think of areas where you might have a situation where, let's say, I'm thinking of in smaller areas, like, say, out where you are, where it wouldn't be unthinkable that you could actually be related to the students in the class.
Yeah, so, and I mean, this kind of, you know, this there's always going to be a case where, you know, you might have a mother teaching a son or something like that, and you've got to have a professional line, I think, in relation to that. I think perhaps, though, that as long as you somebody in your class who is, you know, maybe you might be friends with them, maybe you might be a friend of the family or something like that. This sounds like it makes sense. There's one area, Michele, though, that strikes me where this could be a problem, and that is where a class might want to teach, or a teacher might want to actually do a project using social media and find that they're now prohibited from doing that because they cannot work with their students on Facebook because that is against the code of conduct.
Yeah. that obviously is the downside. But then again, you know, the other side to it is, I mean, is that such a bad thing? Mm. I mean, can they achieve the same kind of goals using other tools?
You mean using other social networks besides Facebook?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, you know, is there, you know, what, you have to kind of get that balance. And I think, you know, that's going to be an area where these kind of policies will need to be thrashed out further. I mean, would you need to, I don't know, have some kind of scenario whereby the parents have to sign off on this kind of relationship thing, and it's just more strictly controlled.
I think you're right. You know, this teachers are always involved in all kinds of projects with kids outside of school hours, off of school grounds, all kinds of things like that. And again, there has to be basic procedures and best practice, I think, applied in cases like this. And this is probably something that's going to be developed further. But I think most people would agree that sort of casual friendship, maybe not project related or anything like that, on social media between teachers and students and in their charge is probably not necessarily a good thing. Let's take a break, Michele. We'll do our little halftime talk about Black Knight and what you're offering this week. We've talked about .co, big announcement for you in relation to that, of course, because it's as you say, they haven't signed up with that many registrars yet at this stage, and they're kind of exclusive about how they go about that. What else is there you want to talk about this week?
Well, I mean, the .co thing is obviously something we're going to be harping on about now for a long time.
Very good.
The other ones, I mean, we're still pushing the, you know, the GoMobi free 30-day trial. We've got that excellent offer on .be domain names, and you know, the .co. We'll be doing more stuff with them as well. I mean, so, you know, there's a lot of little bits and pieces that we're working on. And, you know, some of these things, I suppose, you know, they may not appear like a huge amount to the public, but for those of us who've been working on them for months and months and months, they are the fruit of a lot of labour, you know.
Technology.ie is brought to you by Ireland's premier hosting and domain registration company, Black Knight. Black Knight offer a comprehensive range of hosting and domain solutions for businesses of all shapes and sizes, no matter where they are in the world.
You're listening to Technology.ie, the podcast brought to you by Black Knight. Conor Muinichon is my name, and Black Knight CEO Michele Nealon is joining me on the line from Phoenix, Arizona, in his hotel room. We're recording this afternoon, Irish time. Morning, your time, Michele. And for once, we've given up on the hotel Wi-Fi.
Oh, we had to, unfortunately.
So I'm using Skype out to you to a landline, which is the hotel phone in Michele's room in his hotel in Phoenix. Michele, we wanted to talk this week about, I suppose, the advocacy that you engage in, and your column appeared in the Sunday Business Post on last Sunday, and you're making a case for government really to take leadership here and to start actively setting internet policy and encouraging best practice in Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, this is something which I've mentioned in the past, and it's something that, you know, if you're unfortunate enough to be an Irish politician and you give me your ear for more than 10 seconds, I will probably launch into this at some point. I mean, the problem is that Ireland has attracted a huge number of big names in the digital realm. I mean, you've got eBay, you've got Facebook, you've got Twitter, you've got Google, Amazon, and the list goes on and on and on and on. And you've got other companies in the high-tech space. You've got the Intels, you've got the Dells, you've got the EMCs, Apple. A lot of these companies are doing a lot of business online or are heavily involved in online business. And our politicians, it doesn't matter which political party they're from, pretty much all of them love to get up and talk about, you know, the knowledge economy and how Ireland is digital friendly and how we're going to play this wonderful role and blah, 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 blah. But the reality is they're not engaging. And by that I mean, we mentioned the IPv6 thing in the first part of the show today. Government hasn't actually got the finger out. None of the Irish government websites are currently available over IPv6. Where's the leadership there? They're not available over IPv6. That is embarrassing, to be perfectly honest.
That would be a first step, as you point out, and a second, as you suggested as well, would be to insist that applications for tenders would support IPv6 as well.
Yeah, I mean, these are simple, practical things. I mean, the government itself, its agencies, its funded bodies, you know, all those entities. I mean, there's a lot of them. Control millions of euro in tenders for products, services, you know, in technology. I mean, you see the tenders going out all the time. You know, it's through those kind of tenders that government can gently or not so gently push forward certain things. And I mean, I'm not saying make IPv6 obligatory, but it should be something that, you know, would be on the list. When it comes to the entire internet policy space, you know, there are various fora internationally. There's the internet, the Intergovernmental Forum, the IGF, there's ICANN, there's RIPE, there's ISOC, there's a lot of different organizations that meet to discuss internet policy and how it'll affect users, be they business users, end users, businesses trying to offer services online. I mean, look at the copyright debacle we had earlier this year. You know, the government seemed to be completely blindsided by the entire thing. And they shouldn't have been, because it's not as if these things aren't being discussed. They are. But you go to one of these big internet events where they're talking about policy, and I'm not talking about an internet industry event with lots of stands and exhibitions and people selling things. I'm talking about meetings where governments, semi-states, and business engage with each other, and they're driving internet policy. The Irish government isn't there. They're not there. They don't turn up. Not one of them. They don't even bother dialing in or following it remotely. They haven't a clue what's going on. It's quite embarrassing.
Does it matter, Michele, and putting it another way, right, I'm just going to put the cat among the pigeons with a question here from a devil's advocate point of view, I guess. But, I mean, there is a case to be made that the less regulation, the better, the less involvement, some might say, by government, the better. Let the government stay out of the way and we'll build our internet.
Oh, that's sweet. Aww. That's so cute. I mean, that's fine as a concept, Tom, but the problem is this.
Yes.
Other governments are getting involved.
Right.
And do you honestly think that the UK government, the US government, the Chinese government, the Russians, and all of these ones aren't getting involved?
And they're representing their interests as governments. Ireland ought
to... Not only are they representing their interests, Con, they're pushing their interests.
Yeah, and the interests of their own business communities, I guess, as well.
You take for example, okay, talking about domains again, but no, let's look at this very, very simply. If you have a .com domain name, it doesn't matter a damn who you've registered it through. It doesn't matter whether you've registered it through ourselves, through a company anywhere else in the European Union, or a company in Asia. Ultimately, all of .com is run by an American company. An American company subject to U.S. law. We've talked about this before, about when we talked about domain takedowns and the like. So, U.S. government policy in the internet space. If, for example, Washington decides that no domain names can exist with an expletive in the string,
yes,
then they could force that. They could, and I mean it's I know it's a bit of a ridiculous example, but it's not that ridiculous. But I'm trying to give you a concrete one. If they were to force that kind of law through and make it binding on all U.S. companies, then that would be binding on VeriSign.
What was that? Can you remember the name of the Irish place name recently, which fell foul of, I think it might have been Facebook in terms of the name of the place. I think Facebook weren't allowing it. Just Googling to see if I can remember. Do you remember the one, no?
No, I missed that one story completely, sorry.
I'll find it for you. Let me just take a look at this because
keep rabbing away whilst you do that. I mean, the other aspect to to the piece was as well that, you know, that government needs to help small businesses get online.
Yes.
And encourage them to get online. You know, and it's, you know, the idea as well of encouraging small business growth. Because there's still a huge number of small businesses in Ireland. I mean, not just in Ireland, but obviously we're an Irish company, so we're more interested in Ireland than other places, that don't have any online presence whatsoever. So they're missing out.
Yeah. It's Effin, actually, I think it was. Effin, E-F-F-I-N, which is in County Limerick. Facebook has buckled to the campaign of locals in the County Limerick parish of Effin by allowing them to name it as their hometown. Oh yeah, it wasn't valid as a location. The social network did not allow her to include her home parish on her Facebook profile. This was a woman from Effin called Anne-Marie Kennedy, apparently because it sounded like a person squaring. And there's another article Google has thrown up. I just googled place names and things like that, and Facebook and Google has thrown up great SEO work, by the way, by thejournal.ie, which comes up and consistently scores high in search results. But they've got a nice story about Bastardstown, Muff, Crazy Corner, Welcome to Ireland, and the story about the Austrian village of Fucking, which decided to take a vote on whether or not to change their name.
For God's sake. all fun and games.
Yes, there's also intercourse in Pennsylvania in the US, dildo in Canada, frog suck in Wyoming, and middle fart in Denmark. I'm sorry, Michaela, I've completely lowered the tone of the technology.
You have. I'll add, there's condom in France.
Anyway.
True story.
Your case is well made, Michaela, right, about the need for leadership. And I asked you before, do we need a minister for the internet at junior or at cabinet level?
It would make sense. Mm. I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. Mm. I mean, it's not something that you can... I mean, look, how many people do Google now employ in Dublin?
Mm. Don't know.
I don't know. I don't know either. I mean, a lot. How many jobs are supported indirectly by Google? Yeah. And how many... And you can ask the same again about any of those big companies that have set up in Dublin. I mean, it's not just the number of people they employ directly. It's all of that goes with that. And that's significant. It's not something you can ignore.
Something I've heard recently as well, I've heard a lot of talk about data mining in relation to freedom of information. You've talked as well about, for example, the fact that checktheregister.ie is doing it all wrong. It ought to have an API. And I see this week that President Obama, I think it was last week on the 23rd of May, has issued a directive that requires all agencies to establish programming interfaces for internal and external developers to use and make applicable government information open and machine readable by default, full stop, unquote. And you can see that would open up, hopefully, the hope would be that this would open up all kinds of mashups and all kinds of potential interesting developments by private individuals and companies with what is essentially public data.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really cool. I think this is really cool. This is the kind of leadership that, you know, you need to have. You know, make it so that it's available. If people want to do stuff with it, they can. Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
But for that, I mean, this is coming from the White House. It's coming from, I don't know, is it a CTO or a CIO that US presidents have been appointing for the last number of years. Again, it's a minister for the internet that comes up with this kind of initiative and legislation.
Well, this is it. I mean, the Americans, they may have their failings in some areas, but they're not stupid. They know that these things are important. They know that they need to be dealt with, and you know they've taken positions on this, and that's what you need.
They also know that you can use the internet for acts of war and sabotage against, I suppose, Cold War or cyber war against other nations as well. News came out in the past week that Stuxnet, the virus, I suppose you could say, that which targeted Siemens equipment and in particular had implications for and was apparently directly targeted at Iran. It has emerged this week that was in fact initiated by the governments of the United States and Israel.
Yeah, there's been quite a bit of talk about this kind of thing over the last few weeks. Sure, there's been media coverage of some of it, but there's other ones with which, you know, people are kind of going, hold on a second, you know, is there, are governments involved here? It's quite worrying, but then I suppose it's just inevitable. I mean, it's just, you know, if you're going to get involved with anything these days, you're going to have to look at an online aspect of it. You can't ignore it. But, you know, do you have some way of dealing with it, I suppose, is the real question. What do you do? I mean, even this morning, for example, just watching Twitter feeds, I see, you know, LinkedIn has had an issue. They've seemingly a whole load of user passwords on there were compromised. Last week, it was Cloudflare that was hacked. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on in terms of websites and services being hacked. Some of it's being done by private individuals. Some are being done by big gangs. And hey, some of it might involve governments as well. You know, that's perfectly feasible.
Well, it's hardly top of the list of unsavory activities that governments have conducted clandestinely in order to protect their own interests. But it's extraordinarily, I suppose, surprising and in a way kind of effective and impressive, Michele, that the way the story of this particular Stuxnet malware and how it was actually somehow smuggled inside this Iranian purification plant, which actually was completely disconnected from the internet. They had to use some kind of social engineering to get the actual malware into the plant. But when they did, it went to work and literally destroyed equipment and set back their nuclear program by months.
I mean, this is the kind of thing that, you know, we've seen it. You know, Hollywood and pumping out films with these kind of things for years. It's now it's happening in reality, or at least we're finding out about it. I mean, the other side to this, Con, is, you know, a lot of stuff has been going on for years, but it's now one of the beauties of the internet is we're actually learning about these things, because it's very, very hard to hide these secrets now.
And
so, I think it makes it quite interesting as well.
That is so many people would argue the beauty of the internet, in a way that, you know, you can do so much. You can it certainly puts all kinds of tools into the hands of spies and that. But ultimately, and is this my innocence again showing, Michele? I don't know. Ultimately, does the internet draw back the covers and shine a light? Ultimately, perhaps on all of this stuff in a way that has never been possible before.
Well, it's like with the entire thing about, you know, the WikiLeaks and everything else. I mean, it's, you know, no secrets, everything's out there, and, you know, there's going to be positive sides to that, and there's going to be negative sides to it. I mean, you look at it in terms of certain things, you kind of go, right, well, you know, this is much greater transparency, which forces a greater level of integrity and honesty. But of course, other things might be pushed out there that maybe it wouldn't, it, you know, how can I put this, that maybe putting it all out there immediately could have a detrimental effect. I mean, if you put people's lives at risk by publishing certain things immediately, that probably isn't the wisest thing to do.
I guess at the end of the day, though, it for those in power, it makes them think again, bearing in mind that it's now more likely than ever that every action you take will at some point become public at some point in the future. And, you know, are you going to be able to live with that? Are you going to be able to weather that political and public opinion type of a storm? It's you know what, Michele, I think we're going to do a special program on this at some stage. And I can think of a number of people we could invite as guests who have expertise in that area, not just worldwide, but indeed in particular in Ireland as well. There's quite a few bloggers have been at the forefront in relation to freedom of information and things like that in Ireland. We're going to get back to it, I think, Michele. We're going to get back to you and talk to you again next week. When do you return from Phoenix, Arizona?
I leave here Sunday afternoon. I arrive back Monday afternoon. I mean, it's basically a 24-hour trip, I think, almost.
Well, fair play to you, Michele. As I said, talking about policy and debating with like-minded people from around the world, doing all of that so some of us don't have to. I do appreciate it, Michele. Until next week, bye for now.
All right, thanks, Tom.